watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica, U.S., WYQZ, Warrenton-Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. I'm Lynn Gary, and this is Unwelcome Guests. Last week, I resumed the readings from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education, beginning a new chapter that dealt with the intersection of the eugenics movement with mass education in the early 20th century. The eugenics movement attempted to give racism a scientific gloss as part of their larger program to quote-unquote improve the nation by weeding out people they considered to be defective breeding stock. One of the policies they advocated, and in some instances were able to implement, was forced sterilization of certain people they deemed to have inferior genes. These people, of course, were always of the lower socioeconomic classes. Like the Calvinists before them, they believed poverty was proof of inferiority. Hitler was a big fan of the American eugenicists, who were the inspiration for the Nazi extermination program. In what I read last week, Gatto gave an impression that I would like to correct, that the Planned Parenthood Foundation was somehow a part of this movement. This is just plain false. Planned Parenthood was the creation of a great American shero, Margaret Higgins Sanger of Corning, New York, whose lifelong battle helped to restore to women our most basic human rights, control of our own bodies. The legalization of contraception and abortion was, as we will hear this week, a battle led by women for our liberation. We'll begin the program with a short piece about the life of Margaret Sanger. And then I have a very interesting interview with one of the Janes, a group of women in Chicago in the 1960s that took matters into their own hands and provided safe abortions during the dark days before Roe v. Wade. And we'll conclude the program with a further reading from the Underground History of Education. Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker are the co-hosts of a weekly radio program in Madison, Wisconsin, Free Thought Radio, which is a project of the Freedom from Religion Foundation that advocates for the separation of church and state. They produced this profile on the life of Margaret Sanger. Theirs are the voices you'll hear next.
On September 14th, 1879, Margaret Higgins, who would later be known as Margaret Sanger, was born in New York State. Margaret watched her own mother die at age 48 of tuberculosis after bearing 11 children. That experience changed not only the course of Margaret Sanger's life, but world history. As a young child, Margaret was introduced to the power of the Catholic Church when the local priest locked the doors of the town hall to prevent famed agnostic orator Robert Ingersoll from speaking in Corning, New York. Margaret later wrote in her autobiography of the spellbinding experience of hearing Ingersoll speak under a canopy of trees. She would later personally, repeatedly experience being locked out of public halls, even countries, under pressure from the Roman Catholic Church. Her experience doing obstetrical nursing of the poor in New York City as a young mother galvanized her conviction that women had the right to control fertility. Sanger's turning point was witnessing the death of patient Sadie Sachs from a second illegal abortion. When the 28-year-old mother had pleaded with her doctor for birth control, he responded, "Tell Jake to sleep on the roof."
Margaret Sanger then researched contraception, helping to coin the term birth control while she was editing a monthly newspaper called The Woman Rebel in 1914. The purpose of that newspaper was to challenge the 1873 Comstock Act, which classified contraception as indecent articles, and preventing the dissemination of contraceptive information.
And did you know that Wisconsin was the very last state in the Union to repeal its law forbidding unmarried people to buy so-called indecent articles? That was in the mid-1970s. If it was up to the Wisconsin legislature, that law would not be repealed. That was by court action only.
Facing 45 years in prison when indicted under the act, Margaret Sanger fled the country, leaving behind a book called Family Limitation. It sold 10 million copies while she continued her research in England and in the Netherlands. When she returned to the U.S., she was rearrested. Then her young daughter, Peggy, died of pneumonia in 1915. Devastated, Sanger went on a headline-making speaking tour to challenge the charges, which were dropped in 1916.
Margaret Sanger opened the very first birth control clinic in America in 1916, which was soon raided. She spent the next two decades educating physicians about birth control and overseeing the creation of birth control clinics in America. In 1934, Margaret Sanger brought the lawsuit that finally overturned much of the repressive Comstock Act. Over her lifetime, Margaret Sanger was jailed eight times. She personally brought diaphragms to the United States and distributed them. She helped develop contraceptive jelly. She founded Planned Parenthood, and she commissioned the creation of the birth control pill. Doing more to free women than any other individual, she was hailed as the heroine of history by H.G. Wells and named Woman of the Century by a U.S. magazine, I think that was Life, in 1966, the year of her death. Margaret Sanger's motto, "No gods, no masters."
It might have been Time magazine, if I remember. One of those two called her the Woman of the Century. For more about Margaret Sanger and her views on religion, look up the book that Annie Laurie Gaylor wrote called Women Without Superstition. This is an anthology of women freethinkers, including Margaret Sanger, which is available from ffrf.org.
Fittingly, the song we'd like to play today is called No Gods, No Masters. My co-host wrote the song to tell the story of Margaret Sanger.
Margaret Sanger, reproductive freedom was her goal. She said, no gods, no masters. She fought to let each woman take control. Powerful enemies tried to keep this flaming redhead in her place. When they couldn't talk her out, they tried to lock her out. Margaret Sanger never was the type to be deterred. A woman rebel, no matter what the cost, she would be heard.
spreading knowledge, she freed the poor and needy from their fate. Those who detested her came and arrested her. Margaret Sanger looked at women's lives and heard their voices. She knew the difference between repressive laws and moral choices. Because of her efforts, birth control became a household option. But those who hated her, those who hated her, the church leaders, the religious lawmakers, they did everything in their power to stop this uppity woman who defied medieval dogma to its face. They harassed her, they locked her doors, they stormed her clinics, they censored her writings, they arrested her many times and threw her in jail. They forced her to flee the country. And when Margaret Sanger died, they said, "Finally, we can get this country back to traditional values now that this troublemaker is out of the way." Margaret Sanger, the movement she began cannot be killed. We've tasted freedom, the voice that cries for choice cannot be stilled. Those powerful enemies are sulking on the sidelines of her victory. The woman of the century, the heroine of history. She said, "No gods, no masters, no popes, no pastors. Think for yourself. No more dictators. Resist those woman haters and decide for yourself. No gods, no masters, no popes, no pastors. Think for yourself. No more dictators. Resist those woman haters and decide for yourself. No gods, no masters, no popes, no pastors, think for yourself. No more dictators, resist those woman haters and decide for yourself. No gods, no masters, no popes, no pastors, think for yourself.
That piece produced by Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor of Free Thought Radio and the Freedom From Religion Foundation. They're on the web at ffrf.org. Circle A Radio is a collective based in Portland, Oregon at KABU Community Radio. About a year ago, they interviewed Judith Arcana, an activist with the 1960s feminist grassroots abortion service that came to be known as Jane, and whose activities were chronicled in a 1995 book by Laura Kaplan titled The Story of Jane, the Legendary Underground Feminist Abortion Service.
This song is addressed to my sisters, Any man who is present may listen. Any priest, any public official, any physician. But it gives him no license to touch us. We make the decision. Me and Lydia, Rosie and Josie and Dee. We handle these matters ourselves. You'd better believe, or you'd better leave.
We will be speaking with writer and activist Judith Arcana. Judith was a member of the Abortion Counseling Service, better known as JANE, which was an underground feminist clinic in Chicago that helped more than 11,000 women and girls get safe abortions before the Roe v. Wade decision of 1973. Judith was a teacher for many years and taught in schools and universities as well as other venues, including the Chicago Women's Liberation Union and Washington County Jail here in Oregon. She appears in the documentary video, JANE, An Abortion Service, by Danelle Lundy and Kate Kurtz, and she is also quoted in length in The Story of JANE, a book by Laura Kaplan, who is also part of the service.
The Abortion Counseling Service of the Chicago Women's Liberation Union, called JANE, nowadays, we never called it JANE. We called it The Service. And the women who were in The Service were called JANEs. We don't mind that it's called JANE now, but we always have to rearrange our language. The Abortion Counseling Service started in the late 60s, 68, 69 roughly, and began as a referral service. It actually began, as so many things do, with one woman saying, you know, realizing, whoa, this needs to be different. Not that the abortion situation needs to be different. A lot of people knew that, but she was thinking and talking about the finding of people who would provide abortions in Chicago and the Chicago area. And she was able to do some research, find some people who didn't kill the women or use them sexually and who didn't hurt them, that is to say, cause hemorrhages, etc., and therefore was able to recommend those people. And then she started doing follow-up, and then she learned more, and she started doing counseling, and then she brought some other women in because, of course, as you know, abortion is a necessity, and many hundreds, many thousands, many millions of women need abortions. And as soon as the word was out on the street that there was now an organization, a group of women who could give referrals, who did some counseling, who did some backup, and who were decent and who were women-oriented, we were flooded with calls. Now, over a period of time, let's say 68 to the Roe decision in January of 73, that was the history of the service. The service changed from being this one young woman in her dorm room, literally, at the University of Chicago, figuring out how to do this stuff, to then a group, often called a collective, though it wasn't really, certainly not in the beginning. By the end, it grew to be a much more collaborative organization in line with the political goals of feminist movement. But in the beginning, it was all about just getting the work done, and nobody was dealing with political issues, philosophical issues, thematically. Okay, so we start off with this one young woman. We get some more people. Then the group figures out, well, actually, there's only a couple people, all men, of course, who are really good enough. We're going to give them enough business because so many women need abortions that they're going to just work for us. So the service basically had a stable, so to speak, of guys who did abortions. Sometimes they did other people, but ultimately there was one, in my view, the best, who only worked for us. And he did all of the women that we sent to him. Then, when we found out that he was not an MD, because we, in our innocence, assumed that the people who were doing abortions naturally had been to medical school, that they said they were doctors. Well, come to find out that they weren't all doctors. Some were, some weren't. Some were defrocked docs. Some were chiropractors who, you know, were pretty decent and also making a pretty penny. And, of course, the mob always took its cut. And, I mean, it was a very complicated, complicated situation, just like booze during prohibition, just like gambling where it's illegal. Anytime a particular activity is a crime, then there's stuff about paying off the cops, there's stuff about paying off the mob, there's stuff about who actually runs it, who actually has access to it, who's actually making serious money on it. Because, you know, it's like dope. If it's illegal, then the money thing is enormous. Okay, and that was certainly true for a lot of people in those days around abortion. So back to our guy. Our guy, who was a very, very good abortionist and a very cool guy, who thought that we were excellent people and that what we were doing was a good thing. When we found out he wasn't an MD, we said, hey, wait a minute. If he's not an MD and he can do it, then we can do it. In fact, anybody with brains and dexterity and a good heart can do it. And so eventually he taught us. First he taught one, then he taught two, then those two, and he taught some more. And pretty soon he retired, and the service then became a what is now called a provider itself. So we did intake, we did medical histories, we did the counseling, and we did the abortions. And that was the way the service was operating at the time that Roe v. Wade was decided by the court in January 73. And in the few months right after that, there was a huge battle among the Janes who were in the service at that time, some who wanted to continue, knowing very well that women who needed abortions, just because it was legal, were not necessarily going to get better ones or even as many as were needed. And those who said, wait a minute, this is now practicing medicine without a license.
What was the climate before 1973 with people getting illegal abortions?
The climate, that's a good word, was very different from the climate as we know it now in 2005 in the United States. In several ways. One, the one that you were first alluding to, there were lots of people who were doing abortions who were not so skillful. Women are desperate when they need to abort, and they often will attempt stuff themselves with not as much knowledge as would be good for everyone to have. People don't have the knowledge of their own bodies. People don't have the knowledge of what's necessary to do what needs to be done. So yes, indeed, women died. Many women died. Also, the climate was different in this way. In those days, in the years, let's say the couple of decades between World War II and the Roe decision, the attitudes about abortion were very different in the United States, were very different from the attitudes about abortion now. And this is due to the enormous success of the very smart anti-abortion movement, which has been incredibly thoughtful, careful, and, as I say, outrageously successful at setting the terms of defining abortion, describing abortion, and understanding what abortion is. So that now, for instance, when women have abortions that are completely legal and should be, you know, relatively shame-free, so to speak, women are often filled with shame because they have learned to think of themselves as someone who has chosen to murder their own babies. These are the kinds of words. This is the kind of language. This is the kind of thinking that is common, even among people who are in favor of abortion rights and reproductive health education, et cetera. They've been a big success story, the anti-abortion movement. In the years between World War II and the Roe decision, the majority of people in the country, when they dealt with or felt or thought about or considered the concept of shame, for example, just because I used that one before, in relation to abortion, it was the shame of being sexual. It was the shame of being caught. It was the shame of not wanting to be a nice mommy when you were expected to be a nice mommy because you were pregnant. There was a serious difference in the way the choice the decision, the situation that led to the choice and the decision were conceived of, were imagined, were felt, actually, in those times. I believe in the rights of the mother. I believe in mother right, literally. I believe in the power of motherhood being vested in the woman who is the mother, me and all the rest of us who chose to be mothers and are mothers. And I think that our powers need to be used responsibly, intelligently. We need to be informed. And we make choices, and I'm using that word deliberately because that's the pro-abortion rights language. We make choices all the time about the lives and deaths of our babies, our toddlers, our children, our middle school kids, our teenagers, sometimes even our adult children. And this choice is on a continuum. We make choices like, are we going to send our kids to school or homeschool them? Are we going to tell our children to believe in God and what God, if so? Are we going to allow them to be sexual, or are we going to clamp down on them and tell them they cannot be sexual until they don't live under our roof and things of that nature? Are we going to, et cetera, et cetera, fill in the blank. And I think that the choice to abort is on that continuum. Once you're pregnant, you say to yourself, okay, there's a baby growing inside of me. What am I going to do in the next 2 months, in the next 20 years? What am I going to do about the life and possibly the death of this person? And I think that this truncated kind of conversation, pro-life, pro-abortion, eliminates the complicated aspects, eliminates the complexity of what I'm saying to you here. That is, in my view, that should be in the hands of the mother.
Why don't we talk a little bit about security culture then and now? Hmm. First of all, I'm wondering what kind of security you used, what kinds of experiences you had around security. That's one question, and maybe what you did to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And secondly, the question of race and class and the privilege of being a mostly white, probably middle class educated group of women. How did the privilege of being that demographic work as far as, how do I say this?
It was very, yes, in those days.
And
they knew us. Well, there's lots of things to talk about in that really, tightly packed question, which is a great question. One of my favorite stories from the documentary film that I mentioned, the movie about the service, is one day when a Jane was at a demo downtown in Chicago's Loop, a cop called her Jane, and she was not a person whose name was Jane. And when that happened, we talked about it at a meeting or in individual conversations and realized that the Red Squad knew not only who we were, but that we were abortion people. They already knew what we were doing. Now, what we were doing, because it was then and not now, was of absolutely no interest to them, except insofar as when their girlfriends, mothers, daughters, etc., needed an abortion, which was also true of the cops. We were not of interest to them except as a resource, a community resource that did not hurt women. Cops absolutely knew that we were not dangerous and that we weren't in it for the money. But what was striking to us was that in that period of doing stuff around race, doing stuff that was anti-war, doing all kinds of other political action. I mean, there were many Janes who had files because they had done other political work. There were also many Janes who probably had no files until they got mixed up with these other girls, So the general mindset of the populace at large, even the cops and the government, was so different from the general mindset now. We had security practices in place. They would be laughable now, you know, where everything is recorded or filmed and possibly even from six blocks away with some zippity-doo-dah lens that you don't even know exists in the world, you know. But we did have security practices. For instance, everybody came not to the place where she was going to get her abortion, but to another place, a place that we called the front, because it was the front, literally, you know, just like any other illegal business, we had a front. And so if you needed an abortion and you were working with a particular counselor and you had gone through your counseling session and you had made your decision, you would be given a time, an appointment, and an address, and you would go to that address. And that address was the front. And it was somebody's house, somebody's apartment. And at that place would be all the people who were going to have their abortions and their relatives and friends, whoever came with them, just as they would today in a legal clinic. And those folks would stay at the front. And every hour or so, a person whose job that day it was to be the driver would then take four, five, or six women over to the place. We called them the front and the place. And our practice as drivers was never to take a direct route, just in case. But the front and the place weren't that far apart. I mean, after all, we had to be on time. So we did that. And we attempted to not give personal information about ourselves and our homes and our families and our own addresses. But our people had our phone numbers. People came to my house, sat down, had a cup of tea. Or I went to their place, depending. But usually they came to me. I mean, this was true of virtually all the counselors. Yes, there was security. But on the other hand, there wasn't. We were so, it was like a sieve, you know. Also, and this is going to be really hard for people to grasp, I think, now. I mean, certainly people under 40 anyway. There were no cell phones. Answering machines were extremely rare. And the one that we had that was the service phone number was like Paleolithic, you know? And when women would call the number, which we published in flyers and in free newspapers and college and university papers, when they called that number, there would be a recording. And a lot of women were freaked out by that because they weren't used to it. And they would hang up, or they would leave garbled messages. So even though it wasn't 1,000 years ago, technologically it seems like 1,000 years ago because we operate now past the speed of light in terms of the way stuff changes, you know. Mm-hmm. So we did have the answering machine. We did have it listed under a fake name. We did, you know, do the thing with the front, et cetera. We always protected the people who were doing the actual abortions on those days, especially when they weren't us. Once it became us, we were a lot looser because, let's face it, you know, in any given week, I could be the person who was counseling, or I could be the person on the phone taking messages, or I could be the person who was doing the dilation for DNC, or because that was one of the ways that we were growing into far more collaborative toward collective action, so that the notion was that women would learn many different skills and we would all be competent and capable in a variety of ways. So security, yes, and security, no. One very obvious point to make about the issue of security in the years of the service is that for one time, we actually did have a major security breach, and the way that it happened is very telling. We actually did get busted, even though, for the most part, the cops ignored us. And the way it happened was that the sister-in-law of one of the women who was coming through was a very religious Catholic. And when the woman who was coming through the service told her what she was doing, the sister-in-law became very upset. And when she could not convince the woman not to do the abortion, not to come and have her abortion, she called the police. And she lived very far from where we generally worked. And the police in her precinct were not our police, so to speak, you know, the cops who knew the neighborhoods and knew where we were doing stuff. And they put it through. Another element of that analysis needs to be spoken, and it's this, that this happened in a time when the anti-abortion forces were doing everything they possibly could to prevent the Roe decision. It was already on that big conveyor belt that was moving to the court, okay? It was in May of 72. Now, you can be sure that other people called the cops or complained to somebody else about us, and they simply dumped it in the wastebasket because nobody ever bothered us. And as I said, we knew that we were known to them. But this one went through. And so you have to look at what was going on at the time. And Chicago was then, and to some extent still is now, a very heavily Catholic city. And though there were concerned clergy, there were no Catholic priests in the concerned clergy. And this woman may very well have talked to the right people to be able to make that happen. So that needs to be included in our mention of security issues, particularly for its political context.
In Laura Kaplan's book, she's really candid about the internal power dynamic in the group. Mm-hmm. And it seems like part of that was related to security culture around certain things happening, even with beginning to find out this information about the doctor and then doing the abortions where only certain people knew about it. And so there was that fine line of security culture, need-to-know basis versus empowerment of the whole group. And I'm interested in your thoughts on how that all played out.
Well, you've actually laid it out pretty well. That is the way it operated in the beginning. It's happenstance, as it always is in every group, who turns out to be a power wielder, who turns out to join up at a particular orientation or whatever, and then suddenly rises through the ranks, you know? That's luck. But it always happens. And there are people, for instance, I joined the service in the fall of 1970, and very quickly I was tapped by the people who had the most power at that time, because I was seen as someone who should be moved forward quickly. And I did move forward quickly. Now, I wasn't thinking about it in these terms. Now, in hindsight, and even much earlier, but still hindsight, I had a political analysis of what happened. And while it was going on, I was developing a political analysis of what happened, and often said out loud at meetings things that the people and the women who were running it didn't particularly want said. There was one other woman who came in around the time, I think, 3 or 4 months before I did. She and I became very good friends, and we called ourselves privately the princesses who had been chosen by the queens, and that we were being allowed to see the throne. And we had little jokes like that about it. The people who were not princesses had definitely other jokes, let me tell you. They were pissed off. On the other hand, there were people who were not chosen by the queens who actually should not have been. I mean, for instance, I'm thinking of one woman who was emotionally unsuited, and it would have been inexcusable for us to allow her to have the lives of women who came to the service in her hands. She wanted to learn how to do abortions, but she was not right. It's just like a professor in medical school saying, this one is not doing surgery, you know? You have to make these decisions. For making those decisions, it's very dicey. Power is rough. And if you happen to be a member of a group that's been out of power for a long time on purpose, like if you're a woman, then it's news. And you have to really learn from the ground up what power is, how it operates in groups, how it operates inside of you, how to wield it, and how to be righteous with it. It's very difficult. It's even difficult for men. They do such a bad job, and they're the ones who are handed it. So it was very hard. On the other hand, we did a really good job. Before that, I was a high school teacher, and I certainly learned a great deal about power that way, because I don't have to tell you the way high schools operate in the United States. I learned a lot about power as a high school teacher and about the distinctions between the students and the faculty and the administration and the parents and who was allowed to do what and who was allowed to know what and who was allowed to make choices. And that was my foundation I didn't say it like that, but that was my foundation. Then I come into the service and I find a group that is doing this incredibly idealistic thing, doing this extraordinary social service as women, consciously taking feminist action, not a discussion group, not an educational situation. We were actually doing stuff. And the same kinds of power dynamics arose anyway. So that was really a huge recognition for me. Ah, this is not all about high school only, although, of course, I did learn that, I mean, as a high school teacher, I saw that the way tracks and grades and classes were arranged was the approximation of the class system and is out the one of the major ways that the class system is promoted, engendered, designed, defined, and moved forward in the society at large. So I knew that by the time I was a Jane. But in the service, it was a different take. It was a different situation. The classes, the ranks, the jokes about queens and princesses, that was in a different bailiwick, so to speak, a different context. And I had to understand further how these power dynamics needed to operate in yet this other context. We were this radical underground group, and still we had to deal with these issues.
What you were doing is very unique in the time of a lot of feminist groups, as you were saying. Consciousness raising was a big thing, you know, mm-hmm. and this was, you were taking action, and that's very different. And if you could just briefly discuss how that radicalized the women that were involved and your own radicalization.
My work in the service was the crucible of my feminist politics, no question. Prior to that, I was aware of some action on the part of other women, some of it which just looked like a lot of fun, as well as consciousness raising, like the Miss America stuff, you know, in the late 60s. But I really did not have it in my head, in my life, in the way that I behaved. I was not a conscious woman in the world. I was interested. I remember making a joke in 1969, so this women's movement, like, where is it? Where do you go to sign up? You know, I really didn't have... I didn't have the connection. I didn't have the resources. I wasn't a political animal in front, okay? In the summer of 70, I thought I was pregnant, and it would have been a very bad thing to have a child under the circumstances. And I contacted someone that I thought would be able to tell me where to go, and sure enough, he did. He was a medical student. I thought maybe he could do it, or that other medical students knew how to do it, or that they knew the doctors who did it. And of course, in answer to your question earlier about institutions, he said to me, everybody here at the medical school says, call this number and ask for Jane. That was what they were telling everybody at the University of Illinois Medical School in 1970. How's that for a different climate, okay? So I did call that number and ask for Jane. I had this really long, excellent conversation with Jane, who later turned out to have a different name, of course. And I just thought it was so amazing. I was so taken with it. It was like falling in love. Everything she said was so interesting to me. And I had no medical interest. I had no political experience. I mean, I was a decent person, and I was no fool, and I was not a child, but it was a beginning. Well, anyways, it happens I wasn't pregnant. It was just the very longest wait on the planet and then the period. But when I called her up to say, I'm lucky, turns out I don't need it, she said, well, you know, we're taking in new counselors in the fall. And if you're interested, I'll give you the information. I said, well, you know, I am. And so I joined up. And from that moment, everything that I learned about owning power, about being responsible, about believing that individual people have the power of life and death and the power of decent action or indecent action, that we are to educate ourselves. Certainly the issue of women's health. I learned and learned and learned, and I wanted it voraciously. It was so exciting to me. And in that sense, it was radicalizing in the, you know, in the definition of the word radical. It went to the root in me. my curiosity, my intellectual sensibilities, as well as my heart and my spirit. Everything was stimulated by this work. It was righteous work in the world, and it was about women, which here I had been an English major. I never read anything by women except Emily Dickinson and Jane Austen, of course. You know, I mean, that's just one now cliche example. The lives of women, I now say, from the uterus out. I know biology is not destiny, but biology cannot be discounted. Sometimes when women say biology is not destiny, they forget that we are indeed biological at the same time that we are political, intellectual, and spiritual. We can't afford to forget the body. We cannot afford that. Anyway, I was thrilled by being in the service. I was educated by being in the service. My consciousness rose like, you know, like the sun in the morning. That's how my consciousness rose. And it was indeed radicalizing. And it has remained the heart and center of my sensibilities as a woman. For me, it was just such good luck. Such good luck to think that I might be pregnant in the summer of 1970. And then find this amazing opportunity to become so much more, so much wiser, so much more skilled and competent, so much more useful than I had imagined. It isn't that I didn't think I was a useful person, a good person, but it just wasn't in my imagination that I could be that full a person.
We are talking with Judith Arcana, a Portlander who was a member of Chicago's pre-Roe versus Wade feminist abortion service, Jane.
So were a lot of the other Janes political people, or did they self-identify as feminists, or were there a lot of people who just kind of tripped and fell into the organization as well?
Yeah. The woman who was the very first who started it, Heather, who, you know, that Jane was named Heather, she was a political person. She was politically conscious at an age when I didn't even know what it meant to be politically conscious. She was a college student then. And a couple of others were people who had gone south in the civil rights movement. They were people who had done organizing or stuff with landlords and rents. I mean, they were women who really did have some experience as either organizers or activists or both. They were not the majority of the Janes, but they were in the early, you know, 68, 69, those women were the starters, so to speak. The women who joined afterwards, some of whom were like me, you know, when the match struck, we burst into flame. There were others who didn't, who just said, this is important work. This really matters to me. This is a matter of life and death, and I can do something here. But the rest of their lives seemed unchanged, which was amazing to me. And yet, and they were good Janes, you know, they were good counselors, they were good abortionists, they did good work, but they just, it didn't go in any other directions for them. So in answer to your question, they did not become more political in their consciousness and their behavior except for this one thing. And that in itself, in answer to your earlier question, that's a lesson. That's something I learned, that not everybody was going to come in and go out the same way. Mm-hmm. And there were plenty of women who never regarded what they did in Jane, in the service, as political. They said, this is what women have to do to take care of ourselves and each other. This is not about politics. This is about well woman care. And a lot of those women were the ones who started the Emma Goldman Free Women's Health Clinic after the service closed and after the Roe decision, and did pregnancy testing and contraception advisory and so on, but did not perceive themselves, did not conceive of themselves as political, you know, action-taking women. And then there were some, I think that everybody did consider herself. Every single woman in the service did consider herself a feminist, but not the same kind of feminist, you know, which is has always been true, of course. Our group was certainly politically diverse, and I guess I could call it consciousness diverse. For most of the years, the women were white. In the last year, there were a couple of women of color, certainly at least one Latina, one African-American woman who not only were interested but came, joined, etc. You know, were serious Janes. If the service had continued, then that trend would have continued because it wasn't an accident. It was on purpose on the part of the women who joined and on the part of the women who had been in the service before. I would say in terms of class, we were probably evenly divided between middle class and working class women. There were no poor women because poor women don't have the, you know, the time or the access. Mm-hmm. And there were no rich women. Maybe because rich women have always been able to get abortions. They always have. They always will. Anyway, so the Janes were working class and middle class, mostly white. I would say at least two-thirds of us were at least partly, if not to a degree, college-educated people. And a good number of us were mothers. And the age range was from about 18 to 40. Only a small percentage of us were lesbians. And the women who were lesbians were not out as lesbians in the service. The service really was all about abortion. And being all about abortion is a big challenge to patriarchy in the United States and in the world. We certainly did not challenge white supremacy. We started out as a group of white women. By the time the service was done, that was no longer true, but we were not as cool as all that. We were not cool, but we were about providing abortions, and our politics around race, around class, around what are now called gender issues, were extremely various. And we disagreed about a lot of things. There was animosity sometimes among Janes, not open and ugly, and certainly not while we were working. But what we came together for, all these women with really different politics, was to see to it that women who wanted, needed abortions in a time when abortion was illegal, could get them if we could arrange that. And often we did, and we could.
This is just something that I found interesting in Laura Kaplan's book. She had discussed the issue of women of color and abortion and how, especially during the Black Power movement or the Puerto Rican movement, women of color who aborted their pregnancies were often considered race traitors.
Mm-hmm. Trashed big time.
Yeah.
By men and some women, but mainly men. Very hard on those women. And that's, of course, a major issue always across the board, not just, you know, with abortion. But in those days, one of the primary movement issues was around gender, was for women of color to be producing children of color. They were pressed to it. And, you know, it's not my job to explain what those women were thinking, but I happen to know a certain amount about what those women were thinking because a lot of them wrote about it or told me about it. And they were pissed off, of course, to be put in that box by their brothers and their husbands and lovers and fathers. And they had a very hard row to hoe, but they were not fools and they were not weak. And they said, hey, you know what? This is not a good analysis. You want a good analysis? I'll give you a good analysis. And then they did.
Well, feminism, just that term, I think kind of what you were getting at earlier, has a lot of that baggage too, particularly as it relates across different cultures and it being construed as a choice to make of being a feminist or being...
Or being Chicana.
Yeah.
Or being an African-American woman. Or
Who had pride.
Right. Yes, it was an untenable position. And all those smart and powerful women dealt with it. Sometimes they made new language or used old language in new ways, notably Alice Walker in popularizing the term womanism and womanist and rejecting the word feminist and using that word instead. And then others later, including academics like bell hooks, who said, yeah, I'm a feminist. I'm a black woman. I'm a feminist. I'm many things. Can you deal with complexity? So, you know, they took care of business.
One of the things that I was most surprised about that I learned from reading Laura Kaplan's book was the role that a lot of clergy people played in providing abortion referrals, particularly some Baptist clergy in Chicago and New York. Do you know church people that are still working with us?
There definitely are. This is yet another example of the success of the PR. I mean, they control the media, they control the PR. So you could believe that no religious people are in favor of abortion rights. But in fact, that is not reality. In reality, I mean, look at, for instance, the march last April in Washington. The biggest protest march this country has ever seen, according to the cops in the district. And I was there. I was, you know, like everyone else, just blown away by it. And there were many, many religious contingents. Churches sent buses. Also, not just Christians. Muslims were there. Jews were there. Buddhists were there. Lots of folk who believe in a supreme being. Lots of folk who have serious commitment to religious values and mores and ways of being that they consider what their gods want of them were there at that march. And they were talking about children and families in the lives of women in ways that people who completely support abortion rights, like me, can be very happy about. So it is absolutely incorrect to think that they've got a lock on religion, that they've got a lock on God, that they've got a lock on morality, ethics. No way. No way. And if they didn't have a lock on the media, we'd know more about it. Another thing to know about the clergy who supported abortion rights in the period before Roe is that they were very seriously organized in favor of abortion rights. Before Jane actually did abortions, Jane was a counseling and referral service, just like the clergy concerned. They were a counseling and referral service. And what's really even more striking is, remember, this is a time before women were cops and before women were doctors and before women were clergy. We're talking about men. We're talking about priests and rabbis and ministers. We're talking about the priest of a high Episcopalian congregation counseling young women and married women in their 30s and 40s who come into his office in the house that they live attached to the church, where they have that sweet little office, and they're helping their people. Well, the people they were helping included women and girls who needed abortions. They were doing that then. They were doing it organized across the country. There were clergy concerned chapters in big cities all around this country, and they worked together with Jane. If they couldn't find somebody in one or another venue, then they would call Jane, because they had their set, we had our set. They had their abortionists, we had our abortionists.